drop. We've had the choice of making sure we have all American products and all American labor, or we could have some of the manufacturing take place with care as an outsource, offshore. You and I, as of running a business, would probably be forced into doing the second in order to stay competitive. Otherwise, we'd be out of business. We'd be designing a great product, but the price would be too high. And it's a little bit disappointing that it's got to be that way, but there's lots of evidence that that's going to be the future from now on. We'll do the engineering in many cases, although sometimes even the engineering or the program writing is done outsourced. Right now, the countries of India, Bangalore, India, is doing a lot of software writing, as is Ireland. Those are two countries that are now doing a lot of outsourcing of computer program writing. But as I said, there's still a lot of good work of research and development taking place in the United States at quite a few companies on Long Island, believe it or not. That's an opinion. Okay, anyone else with any further questions or comments on all that you've heard tonight? Give me a call with a name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Okay, that was a triple. I heard N2EO. I heard Glenn, QIQ. And thank you, Glenn, for that beautiful material you mailed me. Kept me reading for a long time, as you said. Lots of dense information there about modern-day switching power supplies, switching regulators, and so on. So I heard EO, QIQ, Glenn. Who was the third person in that triple?
WB7ABF, New York.
WB7ABF in New York. Okay. We'll get you guys in that order. Rich first, N2EO. Go right ahead.
Okay, Dick. Just wanted to say good evening, but you know I've been listening.
Hey, you're always there. We know that. Thank you, Rich. Glenn, as I said, thank you very much for that information you mailed me. You have beautiful stuff. KCQQIQ, K2IW in the TechNet.
Oh, you're welcome, Dick. Anytime. It's great. Actually, my question is about that IEEE consultant that you're mentioning. That's certainly of interest to me. I wasn't aware that something like that on Long Island here. Is that something that you have to first be an IEEE member, or you could become one as you go down the line? Maybe you could just add a few more words about that. Maybe somebody with my experience might be able to benefit from something like that.
Oh, without a doubt. I know some people that 2 years out of college decided to go into consulting. Two of the members of the 40 members of the IEEE Long Island Consultant Network, two of those members, within a couple of years coming out of school, decided to go into consulting and have been doing it ever since. So some people at a very young age do it very successfully. I will admit the majority of consultants have, let's say, 20 years of experience. But it doesn't have to be that way. Yes, to be a full member in good standing, you have to be an IEEE member. But you can do that later. The meetings are open to the public. Attend as many as you want. And half the time they serve food, and you're allowed to eat the food, even though you're not a member. It's a good group. Irwin Wheatman is the founder. I think he did the founding in roughly 1975 or so of the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. It meets the very first Wednesday of every month at Briarcliff College in Old Bethpage in the great room in the back of the building, of the main building at Briarcliff College. Every issue of the Long Island Pulse, the monthly newspaper of the Long Island chapter of the IEEE, advertises the meeting. There's a website. If you Google Long Island Consultants Network, IEEE Long Island Consultants Network, you'll find them real fast. And their website gives you a lot of explanation. It's a little bit difficult to navigate their website at first. You'll eventually figure it out. You'll eventually find a great big matrix. Let me drop. They have a great big matrix where vertically you've got 40 names of the 40 consultants members. Horizontally, you've got about 60 or 50 skills. And there's a bunch of X's on this matrix as to which of those 60 skills each one of those 40 people claim they have expertise in. Dues to be a full member and get a website from them is $100 per year. By website, I mean as a dues-paying member, they will supply you a website that advertises your skills. And you take a look at my name, and you'll see what I claim as a skill. And so I get quite a bit of business from that. Quite a bit of the business I get is from word of mouth. But when a person asks me, gee, I like what you say, I like the way you talk, I think I want you to work for me, send me your resume. To which I say, I don't have to send you a resume, go to the website and read. There it is. And it makes things very simple. It gives it a little bit of air of authority. In other words, the fact that somebody can go to a website from the consultants network, dial in my name, and read a page of what I claim for my skills and my past experience, they put it all together and say, yeah, that's the guy I need. And so I get more work than I know what to do with, and I've got to turn it down from time to time. So I recommend, we've already had the meeting for this month, but the very first meeting in May, I don't know who the guest speaker is going to be. Roughly half the time, the guest speakers are very interesting people. Sometimes they're not quite so interesting, but the price is right. And as I said, you'll be rubbing elbows with guys that have been in the business for a whole lot of years. You can hear their war stories. You can compare their good news, their bad news, their jokes, and whatever, or what it's like being in the business. They teach each other how to run a successful consulting business. Now that I know what it's like, and I've been doing it for 7 years, I'm saying to myself, gee, I wish I had started earlier. I like the independence. I set my own hours. I set my own days of working. I decide who I'm going to work for. I decide what project I'm going to work on. I choose the projects that don't have so much hassle. I choose the projects where the person financing the project understands the physics and has the wherewithal to do it correctly. And if he doesn't meet that criteria, I don't have to accept him. It's kind of nice to have that freedom. I bet you'd get a kick out of that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW on the TechNet. And by the way, you can also do it as moonlighting.
No, thanks very much for the information, Dick. I've been through kind of a stormy working year. I got laid off just before Christmas time, and I was back to work within a couple of weeks right after that with another company. But it just seems like it would be nice to know of a little bit more camaraderie with engineering and seeing everything going overseas the way that it has. Sometimes there's comfort in numbers, if you know what I'm saying, and going to a group like that might be a good thing. Thanks for the information, K2RIZ and K2QIQ. I'll definitely be looking into that.
I do recommend that. A good group of guys. Of that group of 40 people, and about 30 of them will show up to any one meeting, maybe 25 or 30. There isn't one guy in there that you will dislike. You've got patent attorneys, you've got computer experts, you've got high-speed circuit experts, analog and digital. You've got RF experts, a couple of antenna experts, people on court testimony experts, a little bit of everything. Whatever raw information you need in order to get a professional engineering license, those people have those skills. In fact, by attending their meetings, you get points toward your PE degree. Ain't that nice? Other than that, you'll like it. Try it, you'll like it. One of the guys who should have been a consultant a long time ago is Mel. I don't know why he hasn't done that yet, but he's thinking about it. But he does private consulting. He's got this website that people, he's got this email address. Lots of people write him lots of letters, and they get free advice from him. I'm a bit amazed by that. I'm amazed at the enthusiasm. I bet you've gotten some interesting letters this week, Mel, and I think you ought to dig into your mailbag and tell us about a couple of those, or discuss anything you'd like. K2KEY. K2RIW.
WA2CDO for information.
Stand by, Mel. Go ahead, Andy.
I just wanted to start home. I can't stay long, but I just wanted to interject something unrelated to what you're talking about, but then again, it is related. So I have the permission to do so for about 2 minutes.
I'm waiting for the beam. Yeah, you got 3.5. He's the man who controls the repeater. We better treat him well. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, and I thought there was another station that also checked in after N2EO that you didn't acknowledge yet, just to mention that. Actually, I'll mention that now. When N2EO and, I forgot his call, the station we were just talking to, there was somebody else also you acknowledged, but he didn't come back yet.
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad you brought it to my attention. Whiskey Bravo 2 ABF, I think it's Alpha Bravo Foxtrot. Sorry, I forgot you, sir. Start off with your name. Give a little bit of a delay until you hear the beep. Start off with your name and go right ahead with your question or comment. AB7ABF, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, gentlemen. Whiskey Bravo 7, Alpha Victor Foxtrot, Rob, Romeo Kilo Bravo. And we've spoken before, and again, very interesting, fascinating to hear the discussion of the duplex filters for broadcast industry. My question is a simple one. As I'm not an engineer, but I'm kind of trying to get into learning about these things. What do you think of MIT open course software? That's the online resources of MIT. They have undergraduate circuits and electronics courses, which they've uploaded, which are not too abstract, and certainly appeal to me as sort of an academic person who's trying to tie together my interest in kit building with some theory, basic stuff, analogs. Have you heard of these things before? Dick, this is WB7ABF.
Very fine, Roberto. Yes, I've heard of them, but no, I don't have a lot of experience with them. Many of the people who I work with are very skilled at doing computer modeling, whether it be photosynthesis, circuit synthesis, high-frequency structure simulator, touchstone, and whatever. Many of these programs will synthesize a filter, synthesize three-dimensional or two-and-a-half-dimensional structures that have microwave capability. Some of the fancy antenna modeling programs like numeric electrocode, NEC, NEC, mini-NEC, YO, Yagi optimization. There are programs that can optimize almost anything for you. I have, in the last 5 years, been a co-patenter, a co-inventor of now 15 patents on various kinds of antennas. The unique thing about the antennas that I am involved in the patents of is that until very, very recently, they were beyond the capability of the currently available modeling program. So I'm a person who puts a lot of faith in empirical testing. In other words, you give me the right kind of a laboratory with the right kind of test equipment, a real good network analyzer, an anechoic environment, the right kind of a reference antenna, and you give me a difficult requirement of a small amount of space and a lot of performance and a lot of bandwidth required out of an antenna, by empirical means and experience, I designed those antennas. And some of the antennas of my most recent patent, you simply do a search with the patent office under my name, and you'll find some of these antennas, and you'll see what's unique about them and why they are beyond the capability of the currently available, at that time, modeling programs. So modeling programs can do magic, but they don't do everything. And occasionally some of them still require a fair amount of what's called PCO, post-computer optimization. The computer program, depending on the quality of the program and the quality of the raw data that you put into it, can get you into the town, into the ballpark, very close to home plate, but not quite at home plate in many cases. You still have to do some tweaking in the real world, but in many cases, the modeling program can do a lot of experimenting for you before you start building it in physical hardware. My particular antennas require such elaborate finite element analysis because they are reasonably extensive wide chunks of sheet metal that the amount of elaborate, let me drop, the amount of complexity of the finite element analysis would be a sufficiently large matrix of data that for the program to invert that data to do the optimization would be very slow and very time-consuming. We have done some modeling attempts at some of the devices I've worked on, and the modeling takes a significant number of hours to come up with one single answer. Whereas with the tweaking in the real world that I can do, I can build you five antennas in an hour, but it might take you 5 hours to model one of them. I get more for less out of the empirical world. That's just my particular way of doing my particular business. Maybe it's a little bit unique. So, as you can tell, I'm not a big user of modeling programs, but I talk to and touch shoulders with the people who do it, and some of the programs are very good. Now, the particular programs you're mentioning, I don't have personal experience. That's the main thing I think you're asking, Roberto. I don't have personal experience, so I can't give you a testimonial. However, if you repeat their names one more time, we will find out if somebody is on frequency tonight who does have experience and can give you some good words or bad words. WB7, Alpha Victor Foxtrot, K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Bye-bye. Okay, back to you, Roberto.
K2RIW, WB7ABF. Well, fascinating. Actually, my question was much more mundane. I didn't explain myself. It was actually a really, really simple question. But what you said certainly strikes a chord with me as a musician. I mean, a lot of computer modeling programs do not equal the results that you get in the orchestra when you're writing for it, as you will recall I am in music. Actually, Dick, although that's very fascinating, and I very much admire your work, and it's certainly beyond technically, my question was about learning resources online for basic analog and digital electronics, and what you thought about the MIT open course software, not so much modeling programs versus higher end stuff. Because I'm building QRP rigs, you know, simple oscillator circuits and whatnot, but I kind of like a little bit more theory, but theory that's not too simplified, but on the other hand, that's sufficiently abstract to retain one's attention. But like you say, the hands-on kind of thing, and I love that expression you used, PCO, I believe it was, post-computer operation, because ultimately any kind of building or construction of anything comes down to that. So forgive me if my question was leading you down the path, and because it was more complex, it wasn't my intent to do so. So carry on. I mean, if there are other people who are interested in the topic area that you're discussing, and the more high-end kind of application, by all means, let me know. But my question is simple. What do you think of the MIT open source software, or courseware, for basic instruction in analog and digital electronics? They've uploaded courses from the school. The ones I've seen with an Indian gentleman, Anand Agarwal, seem to be pretty cool. I wonder what you thought about that. K2RAW, WB7ABF in group.
Yeah, sorry, Roberto. I went off on one of my tangents on one of my hobby horses here, on one of my soapboxes. I don't have personal experience with the MIT open source. However, I have seen a number of web-available chunks of data that are mind-blowing. Some of them are extremely good. You choose the right search word with a good search engine like Google, and you'll find 200,000 hits on that particular search word, and you start going through those hits, and there are other search engines that maybe are a little bit more efficient. One of the really good ones is called, all of a sudden I forgot the name of the darn thing. It'll come to me in a minute. But it's a search engine which does a whole lot of parallel searches simultaneously. Goes to the websites, finds out which ones are currently active, rechecks the ones that are not, gives you a couple of sentences out of each one as a great big report. Copernic, that's the name of the search engine, Copernic. Very, very poorly known, unknown search engine. But Copernic will find you a whole lot of information on your particular search words in a hurry. I have discovered that with the right search words on any subject you can think of, and you may have to modify the words, the order of the words, find alternates for them, find the synonyms for some of the words, but when you finally find out how to use a search engine correctly, and there's a couple of books that are available in a good library or in a good bookstore that will teach you how to use the available search engines more efficiently. When it comes to data search, boy, we're in a brand new era. Let me drop. I mean, in the old days, you would have to go to a really good technical library, find a real good librarian who knows where the right books are and where the right card file information is, and learn to find what you're looking for. Nowadays, you can get 10 times more information, 10 times faster, by online searches with the right search engine, with the right search technique of that search engine. You'll find information on any subject you want. For instance, not too long ago, I did a simple search on how does a dipole antenna work. And eventually I came across the Wikipedia information on dipole. My goodness, they covered the waterfront. Wow. It must have gone on for 15 or 20 pages. It's a very simple antenna that you and I used to think was simple, called dipole. Boy, there's a lot more to it. How does an infinitesimal length dipole work? How does a compensated dipole work? Wide, narrow, folded, and so on. How do you predict the impedance, the reactance, and so on, the resistive component, the reactive component of the impedance. So there are search engines that will find you data that will blow your mind and will keep you reading for a long period of time. I did another search not too long ago about dielectric strength of air, high voltage circuits, Wim Hof machine, and Van de Graaff generator. And boy, there's some really exciting information on what's been done in the past on those machines, the pictures of them in operation and so on, and how they work and how to make them work better and how to improve the designs and so on. So we're in a brand new era. When I was actively doing engineering up until the year 2000, in order to have the right research material, in order to know what the vendors are producing, and to know what good textbooks had the raw data that I wanted, reference data for radio engineers was one of my favorites. I've got all 9 issues of that book. Antenna Engineering Handbook, I've got all four issues of that book. These are massive books that really cover the waterfront on those subjects. And I had about 50 or 60 other similar books. That plus all of the data that I needed to run my business professionally as a consulting engineer within a company. In order to house all of that data, because they only allowed you one file cabinet in your office, I had acquired 35 lateral file drawers scattered around the building. In other words, when each person left, I would acquire one of their file drawers, no matter where it was in the building, put my name on it, or somebody else's name sometimes, and start stuffing it with my information. The craziness of the chain of command and the company I worked for is they thought that, gee, you engineers are pack rats. We're going to move you from point A to point B periodically so you throw things out. Well, for me, it didn't work. Because whenever they needed information, I'm the guy they came to.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because I'm the guy that had the data. So the same people who were telling me to throw things out because I'm a pack rat were the same people coming to me saying that, gee, I need information on so-and-so. Hey, Dick, do you have it? To which I said, do you realize it's a forbidden fruit? That your orders were to, 6 months ago, were for me to throw this out, and now you're asking me for that data. So in other words, they had to be humbled a little bit, but they got the data from me. As I said, I had 35 lateral file drawers filled stem to stern with the data required to do my business. Nowadays, I think the data I need to do my business would be a fraction of one file drawer because everything is online. You learn the right search techniques online, and your house doesn't have to be filled up with paper anymore. Particularly if you if you're an IEEE member and you're a member of the Explore technique, and therefore you can, by way of their Explore capability, that's the name of a service you have to buy from them, by way of that you have access to all of the past issues of IEEE proceedings, IEEE antennas and propagation journal, microwave theory and technique journal, and so on. So online, the data is there. And so MIT open source, guarantee, Stanford University, Georgia Institute of Technology, Virginia Tech, University of Boston, each of these schools that have, Ohio University, each of these schools that have a known, significant subgroup that does wireless engineering. I guarantee each one of these have some form of online course that you can get maybe free of charge or maybe for a small subscription, and you start reading through those on the subject of analog and digital design. Guarantee there's a lot of data there. A person who wants to get the equivalent of a master's degree in his own home, as long as he's enthusiastic, I think it's there, go for it. That's an opinion, strongly felt opinion. Again, a little bit off subject, didn't quite answer your question directly, but maybe it helps a little bit, Roberto. WB7 AVF, K2LIW on the second end.
K2LIW, WB7 AVF, no, outstanding, fascinating, amusing, and intriguing as well. Yeah, I think we're all pack rats regardless. I do the same with musical scores, believe me. You have written scores? My God. Yeah, but everything's online now. It's, again, a matter of filtering it and processing information, knowing how to look for it. So I will write all this stuff down and I will look it up. Again, thanks a lot. And won't tie it down. And by the way, the Austin-Fed dipole is working quite well. And I appreciate the gentleman's help. And we'll continue listening, as always, with enthusiasm and interest. And again, I'm not an engineer, but a hobbyist, you know, a tinker of stuff. Not again. K2RIW, WB7ABF and group. On to the next person.
And on this subject matter.
Hey, how we recognize? Turns out, the best antenna designer on the 432 megacycle. The best antenna designer on the 432 megacycle band, way back in roughly 1970, when I really got active in that band. I'm trying to think of the guy's call letters now and his name. Anyhow, he was a violin maker living in Hempstead, West Hempstead, Long Island. I'm having trouble thinking of his call letters and name. Anyhow, this violin maker made some extremely good 432 antennas. He was doing experimenting with 14-element quad Yagi antennas in 1970. Built a very nice antenna. My wife also was taking guitar lessons at the time, and he was teaching her how to properly tune the guitar and repair it when it needed it. So, a real good musician. Vince is his first name. I'll eventually think of his second name. Unfortunately, he's now a silent key. So, I've known a real good microwave ham radio operator who by occupation is a plumber. I've known another very good microwave ham radio operator who occupation is a violin maker and piano tuner. So, what you do as a hobby and what you do as an occupation don't have to be related. In my case, they are. I made my hobby my occupation. So has Mel. He and I were born the same month, the same year. We went to the same school. And the only problem is I wasn't born to the right mother. There's a joke there. Hey Mel, maybe it's time we go to our mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech net.
Yeah, WHCDL, I just
wanted
to make that comment that I wanted to make before
then. Oh, sorry about that. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, just unrelated to what we were talking about tonight, I wonder if anyone saw 60 Minutes tonight and the article regarding radio amateur John K-A-N-Z-I-U-S, I guess it's John Kazus. His call is K3-T-U-P. And his invention, using radio waves to kill cancer cells. That was on 60 Minutes tonight. It started at 8 o'clock. Were you aware of that, Dick?
I did see a listing on, I think it was the website from Limark, saying that program was coming up. Unfortunately, I was not aware of it. The golf program created a delay right up until 7:45. I think that wasn't the first presentation of 60 Minutes. After that, I was on the TechNet. My guess is the presentation about John Kenzie of K3TUP probably took place after 8 o'clock. Is that true, Andy? And why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown? I do know that I believe he had cancer, therefore he had strong motivation to develop hardware to help the cancer situation. Sounds like he's invented something quite significant. And why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown? But was I right that it occurred very close to 8 o'clock or after 8 o'clock on CBS television because of the golf program? WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Okay, ready for the meet. Yeah, that's right. It was right after the Masters. And it was not the first article on 60 Minutes. It was the second one, narrated by Leslie Stahl. I watched it, by the way, because I was watching the end of golf, watching the end of Masters, and it ended just about 8 o'clock, just about the same time that you started the tech band. And I was not listening to you. Anyway, interesting what he came up with. Basically, I won't go into all the different things he spoke about because it's kind of lengthy, but if anybody wants to find out, you can just do a Google search on 60 Minutes, which I'm doing now, and it'll give you the whole presentation word by word, the 4 pages long. But to summarize, he invented this machine that supposedly killed cancer cells by using radio waves, and he demonstrated to Leslie using a fluorescent light bulb in front of a high power transmitter how he could make the fluorescent light bulb light up. And using that, he went on to show that by building this chamber that could radiate RF in an enclosed area, and by using copper sulfate as a target, as a metallized target, you can heat up the copper sulfate and kill whatever it's attached to, or disintegrate in this case, because it wasn't a cancer cell. The doctors at his research lab have been working on that end of it. But he showed the heating effect by using RF, and I believe it's around 3 megacycles, at least that's what I was told, although it did not specify the frequency.
14.
What was that?
Keep point.
Repeat that, please.
Said 14.
14.
NDWB2EAB with a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Ed. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's at a frequency where you don't get a microwave oven effect, or just everything.
You're breaking up a little bit, Ed, but I copied most of that. Okay. I don't quite understand if this really is going to work. The problem is this guy himself has leukemia, and he's got limited time to get this thing to work, and he's getting funding to complete this experiment. They say it'll take about 4 years to test it on humans, but so far, using some mice that have large tumors, they were able to inject a nanometal, I'm not sure what actual substance they use that they inject into the cancer cell and as a target, and then by, of course, heating it up, they kill it, they disintegrate the cell. Although, I'm not sure if this technique is really, if it's really going to work, because I believe this was tried before. I mean, it's a simple, using a microwave oven technique, we know that RF heats up an object that you place into a microwave oven. So his idea is not new, but it's enlightening to the medical industry that's seeing this, and they say that it's a possibility. Anyway, just going to mention that without going into all the details, read the article. It's on Google right now. You can see the whole presentation, which was about half an hour long. So I think back to you, WSTL.
WSTL.
I heard somebody say USG. Want to repeat that? Okay, maybe there wasn't somebody there. No, Andy, I think you're being overly negative. I see a lot of merit in this. Your microwave oven runs at 2450 megacycles, not because that's a magic frequency. It was just a frequency that was available at the time. It was high enough in frequency that a simple cavity structure for the oven could be made in a reasonable size, and that would allow you to, cook a hamburger or a cup of coffee or things like that are convenient. The good news about 2450 megacycles is that a magnetron will produce some nice power there efficiently. The oven will reflect it very well. The RF energy bounces back and forth in the oven until the food or whatever is in the oven absorbs it. You get very high efficiency of absorption. The microwave oven at 2450 megacycles on the average protoplasm-like material, skin tissue-like material, has a penetration of about 1 or 2 centimeters, around 1 centimeter is the penetration. As you go to lower frequencies, like 14 megacycles, the depth of penetration increases. The heating becomes more uniform, more universal, more evenly spread out. I think he's right on that one. That frequency hasn't been used. The hyperthermia techniques that have been used in the past usually consisted of a small catheter-like device that was injected through a vein, and you hope to get it into the right area of the cancer and create the hyperthermia that would create selective destruction of the cancer cells versus the normal cells. Let me drop. My understanding of cancer is that one of the major mechanisms by which a cell turns cancerous is that the mechanism of reproduction within the cell goes haywire, and the cell starts reproducing at a much higher rate than normal, and it no longer has the proper function of what the cell should have in that particular area. So a cancer in your liver, those cancerous cells are no longer going to behave like liver cells. That's the bad news. Also, for the cancer cells to multiply as frequently as they want to, they have to have a prodigious local blood supply to have the raw material to do the multiplying. So what a cancer cell is a combination of a cell that has gone haywire and is reproducing at a much higher rate than it should, and it possesses the property by which it knows how to demand excessive construction of local capillaries to supply it with the nutrients, the extra blood supply that it needs. One of the ways of detecting cancer cells is because that part of the body is running at a higher metabolism and is running hotter. So passive thermal sensing techniques, thermal imaging, can in many cases indicate where the cancer is. The cancer now, once you recognize the mechanism of cancer generation and support, you recognize it contains a vulnerability. It is automatically running at a higher metabolism, consuming more materials in that area, and if you can create selective heating in that area, it is not too difficult to heat the cancer cells more rapidly than the normal cells, because they are automatically running hotter, running at a higher metabolism rate with a richer supply of local blood to them. If you can also simultaneously find a substance that is RF absorptive, that is selective, that by some magic will select the cancer cells versus the normal cells, now you've got a beautiful combination of a selective substance that does local thermal heating and uses the extra vulnerability that the cancer cells have. I think he's got a darn good idea. The idea hasn't been properly exposed up till now, hasn't been properly investigated, because the number of people who have understanding of the mechanism of radio frequency heating are very few. The mechanism of the way your microwave oven works is that it is the water in the food that's doing the vast majority of the absorption of the RF energy and creating the heating. Water at microwave frequencies is a beautiful dummy load. When you get down to lower RF frequencies, the water is not as much of a dummy load. But still, the good news about the lower frequencies, you got greater depth of penetration. So if you've got a cancer that happens to be X number inches below surface, the lower frequencies can get to it a lot better than the higher frequencies would. It's a little bit more difficult to focus the lower frequencies, but with John's technique, he doesn't have to do focusing. All he's got is
repeater, timeout, cancel.
All he's got to do is find the right selective surface substance, whether it be a nano substance or copper sulfate or some other substance. Find the right selective surface substance that is both RF absorptive and will selectively find the cancer cells. It doesn't have to destroy them. All it's got to do is locate itself in the vicinity of those cancer cells, let the RF energy do the excess heating, and now he's got the differentiation of the cells he wants to destroy versus the cells he wants to leave alone. I think he's on the right track. Let me pass it back to you, Andy. WA2CDL, K2LIW on the TechNet.
All right, I think Ed EAV wanted to say something more also. Yeah, the thing is, once it metastasizes, if I said that word correctly, In other words, once the cancer spreads away from where it started and starts spreading to the rest of the body, that's when things become difficult. And that's most of the time they say that's what kills the people when that happens, instead of it being localized. But, you know, with the computer program, they showed how they could, the good news, they could take these, what he calls nanoparticles, whatever they are, some sort of metallized chemical, by taking those and programming them to target cancer cells throughout the body once the cancer starts to spread, then by using John's device, heating them up will kill them. So that's his invention. All right, there's a lot of rebuttal on this. If you look, I'm not going to read all the hits that this article took tonight. So far, looking past the article, people's comments on this invention, if it will work, if it won't work, and so on. There's a lot of information on that. So if anybody's listening to this, you can just do a Google search on that. You can read the whole thing. I do feel it looks like a promising thing that he's got going there. The problem is he's got limited time because of his cancer that he's dealing with. And that's unfortunate. But hopefully in the next few years they'll be experimenting more with this, and maybe this will be the one that's for all cure. I sort of heard Ed Undy wanted to make a comment. Let me just take a pause and see if Ed wanted to say something.
K2KY.
Always. Okay, we're going to go to Mel, who's been waiting patiently, and then Ed in that order. Mel, give us your words on this. And Mel was involved in the TechNet, so he didn't get a chance to watch the program. Over to you, Mel.
Hey, John Hanford. He is using a frequency of 13.56 megahertz, started out with a 20-meter transmitter, actually, and worked his way down and found that working with Dr. Wally, who was a Nobel laureate and an expert on cancer research at the time, and they have found that they were taking the nanoparticles in a solution form, and once the nanoparticles attach themselves to the tumor, what he found that they resonate at about 13.56 megahertz, and of course when they resonate, they're going to heat up, and so far it has showed very, very interesting results, Dick, and of course it's going to take a lot more of experimentation. Experimentation is taking place right now, I believe, at Rice University. But it is not a harebrained scheme. There is a very good theory behind it. It was just a matter of finding a frequency and finding a way that the particles can be actually agitated, just like you said, the microwave. You put a cup of water, you agitate the electrons in there and the water, and it heats up. And that's basically, he's got a system similar to that, Dick, over.
Beautiful. 13.56 megacycles is another one of those frequencies that have been set aside by which you can operate contactless badges. That's a kind of RFID device. The badge that I use to get into a number of the factories I go to runs at 13.56 megacycles. So there's a frequency where you're allowed to radiate quite a bit of power, and thank goodness it's one that's quite selective to what he's doing with these nanoparticles. They might even be carbon nanotubes in solution or something like that. Mr. Gallander, please give us your comments on this. WB2EAV, K2RIW, did you see the program?
WB2EAV. First, Dick, I'm going to tell you your commentary on what you thought was about. If you can take less thoughts, I couldn't what you said from what she said. You nailed it. Second, they did not mention frequency. But I remember 30 years ago reading all sorts of stuff literature about 5-6 gigahertz high power amplifiers used in dying machines. Think I'll bet you a cup of coffee. It's not that narrow band. You would get his hands on some old diathermy machines to build the test setup. Back to you then, WB2EA.
Very fine, Ed. A little bit of dropout, but I'll repeat what Ed was saying if anybody had trouble hearing it there. He thought that what Leslie Stahl said when she interviewed John and what I said had some strong similarity. 13.5 megs is the frequency he chose. He actually used a 20-meter ham radio transmitter and tuned it down to 13.56. He also had his hands on some old diathermy machines. I remember repairing a diathermy machine for a physician way back in the dark ages of 1964, and it ran at 27 megacycles, which was then a frequency that was available for unlicensed products. 27 megacycles and 13 megacycles. The good news about those lower frequencies is that they do some rather deep heating. You put two pads across a knee, for instance, at 13 megs or 27 megs, and you'll heat up that knee joint rather deeply, rather uniformly. That's the good news. The bad news at 13 megacycles is focusing the energy is a heck of a lot more difficult. But with modern-day construction techniques of cavities and whatever, parabolic surfaces, I think it's possible to do focusing. So what John's breakthrough seems to be is the combination of using lower frequencies, using selective substances, and understanding the mechanism of RF diaphragm-type heating. You put that all together. Once you've got a substance that's somewhat selective to the cancer cells, once you recognize the cancer cells are more vulnerable to local heating, they're more selective in the way they have a prodigious blood supply, they're also reproducing more rapidly. Because they're reproducing more rapidly, they're doing more frequent mitosis. If you're doing anything that disturbs the quality of the mitosis, you're being selectively destroying those cells. If you're doing something that selectively eats them, they are more thermally sensitive than normal cells and so on. You put all of this together just right. And even for a cancer that metastasizes, that goes to places, other places in the body, I still see the possibility of this technique that John is talking about being very effective. I hold out a lot of hope for what I'm hearing. I think it's significant. I don't think it's just a flash in the pan. I didn't say it's going to be falling off a log, simple, easy. There's going to be a lot of details to making this work right. But I think they're on the right road. That's my strongly felt opinion. Anyone else want to comment on this? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
N2RSO.
KX. N2RSO and KX, in that order. Mr. RSO, start off with your name, sir, and then your comment. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. The name is Frank. I just thought I'd mention that HF, RF, frequency radiation has been used in other surgical type procedures aside from cancer. As an example, a few years ago, I was diagnosed with cardiac arrhythmias caused by something called PVCs, premature refraction. Now, as it's explained to me in layman's terms, the heart has a primary clock mechanism similar to it's actually your internal pacemaker that controls the heartbeat, and sometimes other clock mechanisms, if you want to call them that, develop within the heart in other chambers and send out a beat that is before the primary beat, and it feels like you're missing a beat in your heart when actually it's adding a beat. All right, getting to the point of it all, I went to St. Francis Hospital and went to a procedure called cardiac ablation, ACLATION, and you can Google this on the internet and find out more about it if you like. But basically, it's a probe that's sent up through the thigh vein up to the heart, and using fluoroscopy, they can actually find the spots that are causing these extra heart rhythms, heartbeats, and they burn them away using not a laser, but HF, RF energy. So I just thought I'd pass that on at 2 hours over.
Very fine, Frank. Yeah, my understanding of the heart pacer mechanism built into a human heart, it has the property a little bit like a shift register, a cyclic shift register. There should be one single pulse running around that circle, giving you one heartbeat at just the right timing. The tap points on the shift register tell each of the ventricles and auricles when to contract. And if something goes wrong with it, more than one pulse running around in that shift register, that's one of the mechanisms by which you go into a condition called fibrillation. And if your heart is beating fast enough and therefore ineffective, it's not pumping blood correctly, you're in a fair amount of trouble. So that cardiac ablation tries to burn away the areas that are exciting the extra pulses into that shift register. That's my way of explaining what I think is going on there. And so that catheter with the RF energy tries to specifically burn an area that they find is a creating the phony signal. Do I have it approximately right, Frank? N2RSO, T2RIW on the deck net.
You've got it exactly right, Dick. And the emphasis is on the fact that they're using HF radiation and not a laser and not some microwave energy. And I was amazed when the doctor explained it to me, and I said, are you sure about the frequency? He didn't know the exact frequency that was being generated, but he said it falls within the area of HF range, which is obviously somewhere between 3 and 30 megahertz megacycles. But, you've got it. Probably one of the better explanations I've heard. Back to you.
You'd be amazed how much shift registers with tap points are used both in the human body and are now going to be used with the fourth and fifth generation digital television converters that we're all about to be using with high-def television. High-def television is quite vulnerable to multipath signals. So those multipath signals must be accommodated, otherwise it creates corruption of the digital data demodulation process. And so the modern day converters have a compensator built in which anticipates the early and late signals that occur because of multipath propagation, and by way of a delay line shift register, a bunch of tap points, and you control the amplitude and the phasing of the tap points, you therefore accommodate, cancel, or add together all of the delayed signals and make them all come out in a common time period that then gets demodulated. That's the way the modern-day digital television converters work. And so it bears a strong resemblance to the heart pacer mechanism that you're discussing right now. Okay, Mr. KX, I didn't hear your whole call. Please give me your whole call, your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KC2KKX, name is Peter. A couple of comments on your RF ablation first. Obviously in the heart, RF ablation is not as demanding as it would be for killing tumor cells. There you're just needing to blunt some of the tissue that's causing the ectopic activity. In a tumor situation, you want to kill as many tumor cells, hopefully all of them. And just a couple of comments. Tumor cells do not grow more rapidly. It's better to think of them as uncontrolled growth. Normal tissues do not, for the most part, turn over, except maybe the skin, GI tract, a couple other examples, or they have a very slow turnover. Most of the time in tumor cells, they have uncontrolled growth. A greater fraction of the cells become turning over. Their mitotic rate as a tissue is higher, but they do not take more time to cell cycle and so therefore the targeting of this substance for RF is very difficult. The angiogenesis that you mentioned creates a problem with uneven heating of tissue, and there are a lot of technical details here that are huge challenges for cancer biology and oncology in general, much more complicated than you suggested.
Thank you very much, Peter. You've given us some nice information. I presume you work in medicine. I wonder, are you a physician or a surgeon, Peter? Go ahead.
I'm a radiation oncologist and also have a PhD in cell biology.
Okay, you're the right man to talk about that. Talk about this. I wonder if you saw the program, and even if you didn't, what little you've heard, do you believe that there is light at the end of this tunnel? Do you think this technique has some promise from what you've heard so far? Back to you, Peter.
Well, first I'd have to say I did not see the program, although I've seen it alluded to. I think it was in one of the magazines, I forget which one, heard about it on the radio. There's certainly a whole literature on using RF for tumor ablation, and it is being used in certain settings at this time, and also to try to identify material or targeted agents that would make it more specific to tumor tissue, as you alluded to.
Okay. My interpretation of what you said is there was some promise, and therefore worthy of much further study. Oncology, cancer in general, very difficult problem. It's no one single problem. Sort of like the word common cold. It isn't one single disease. It's a whole series of virus-like things. So, I think John's on the right track. Yes, he didn't dig deep enough to go far enough to give us anything like a solution yet. But let's hope that he and other people pursue what he has started, because I think it has promise. But that's an opinion. I'm certainly no expert in the area. Mel, let's try one more time. Do you have a mailbag that you want to open? K2RIW in the tech net.
Dick, can I make a closing comment on that, WB2EAV?
You sure can. Go ahead, Ed.
When everybody figures why it takes so long, let me remind you, Philo Farnsworth got the idea that turned into television in 1927. You couldn't buy a television until 1945. Things don't always follow a smooth, strict path.
Yeah, you said 1927 for Philo Farnsworth. I did read one report that he first recorded it to his chemistry teacher in high school in 1915. I also saw the play in New York City recently called The Farnsworth Experiment, or The Farnsworth Development, whatever it's called. And I thought it was earlier than 1927. I could be wrong on that. We'll research that one further, Ed. Thank you for your comments. And I can tell Ed's out doing his midnight constitutional. Mel, K2KEY, try one more time, K2RIW.
I just wanted to make the point that things discussed this.
Point well taken. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY, fine business. All right. Yes, I think we should think, well, it's being continued by some prestigious, people in research, cancer research, so hopefully they'll continue. They find that they see something in this, what they call SWNC. I was just reading about it. Single wall carbon nanotubes that release heat energy when exposed to an RF field. Okay, well, good luck to John. I hope everybody's safe, that he is doing something that really will show some great hope. for the future. Because one of the cancers that my mother passed away from, and that they've had some success on mice so far with that type of cancer. So let's root for John and give him the benefit and say he's on the right track. I think he's doing the right thing. And I hope they are going to continue funding it, continue the research. Okay, with that, hold on. All right, let's see. Let's go down here. What's up on that? Power supplies again. We went through beverage antennas. They want to know about beverage antennas, terminating them. I don't know. I think we more or less covered that to some extent. You can go to amateurradio.tv and look up some of these things. And I could say, let's see. Oh, here's one. Can you please explain antenna efficiency a little simpler? You gave a formula, radiation resistance times 100 divided by radiation resistance plus circuit resistance. Would you please elaborate what the heck you were talking about? All right, you want to take a shot at that again, Dick? We touched upon it, over.
We did touch upon it, and I think it can be made more clear. Somebody has appeared at my house that I've got to talk to for the next 4 or 5 minutes, Mel. I hope you can carry on for 4 or 5 minutes. I'll be back after that time. And even if you want to skip the subject or give it a shot, I'll come back and give my 2 cents on it. I'll be back.